For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome. And for new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zengate. And we're, many of us, in the middle of a two-month practice period of intensified practice, and we're using as inspiration four stories from the Lotus Sutra, one of the perhaps the most important Buddhist scripture in East Asia. And I want to introduce one of them more fully, one of these stories more fully today. This is the strange story from chapter 11 about the appearance of the treasure stupa. So, first I just want to say that this Lotus Sutra has all these interesting, strange, fantastic stories that are intended as inspiration for bodhisattva practice, for our practice of relieving suffering and helping all beings. So this practice we do of sitting upright and being present, of course, is beneficial for ourselves. We can find some inner calm and settledness and openness, but also if doing this regularly, and I encourage doing this at least several times a week or daily. You don't have to do it 30 or 40 minutes like we do here, but even 20 minutes, 15 minutes, just to have a space in our life to be present and upright. But when we do this regularly, we also begin or deepen our feeling of interconnectedness, that we're deeply connected with all beings, that we're not alone sitting here on a cushion or chair. Many, many beings contribute to this. So the idea of the bodhisattva is that we are practicing for everyone and that everyone is practicing for us in some ways, sometimes that we don't understand. This particular story shares with a lot of the other stories in the Lotus Sutra and in other bodhisattva sutras a kind of colorful rhetoric. In the Indian imagination, there were vast numbers and vast scales of size and dimension. And so this is a kind of aid in going beyond our usual conventional sense of reality. And it also has, in the beginning of this chapter and some of the others, talks about many valuable things and this colorful display when the Buddha spoke of jeweled bells and banners and flags and fragrances and gold, silver, lapis lazuli, seashell, agate, pearl, carnelian. Somebody came to me and said, this sounds like a kind of materialist encouragement to a consumerist. From a consumerist context, we should try and find all this gold and silver and stuff. Well, really, this isn't about that. This is, again, this is a story to support our practice. And part of what these ornaments and these vast numbers of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that appear are just to encourage kind of sense of wonder, a sense of awe, a sense of that which goes beyond our usual way of seeing the world. So I want to just go through this, the basics of this story in chapter 11, and then some other things I want to talk about related to it somewhat today. But in this story, there's the Buddha and there's all these beings, and suddenly appears a stupa with all these fancy ornaments. A stupa is a relic of a Buddha. relic of, so inside, I think they have them in Catholicism too, relics of saints and things like that. The stupa is, so in East Asia, pagodas, you may have seen, are a kind of stupa. There are other forms of that in India and Tibet, but these are where the remains of an ancient Buddha are. When I lived in Kyoto, I lived right next to a temple that had this big pagoda. There was a stupa for Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who's sitting in front of the Buddha on our altar and is a kind of archetypal figure, but somehow they had his remains inside this pagoda. Anyway, this great stupa appears and springs up from the earth in front of where the Buddha is speaking the Lotus Sutra, one of his last talks before he passed away, and it stood up in the air, this stupa. And then, from the midst of this treasure stupa, came a loud voice of praise, saying, "Well done, well done, world-honored Shakyamuni Buddha. For the sake of the great assembly, you are able to teach the wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra," which is the full name of the Lotus Sutra, "of great impartial wisdom, the Dharma by which the Bodhisattvas are taught and which Buddhas are protect and keep in mind. It is just as you say, world-honored Shakyamuni, all that you say is true." So this is 11 chapters into the sutra, and there's this strange stupa that appears, and this voice comes from it. And all the assembly, seeing this glorious stupa floating in midair and hearing this voice coming from it, it says, "We're filled with joy in the Dharma and with wonder at these unprecedented things." So again, the point of all these exalted stories is not to try and have some literal understanding of them, but to incite this sense of wonder and even joy. So, when that had happened, one of the bodhisattvas, whose name is Great Delight in Preaching, said to Shakyamuni Buddha, "What is this? Where did this stupa come from, this springing out from the ground, from the earth?" And Shakyamuni Buddha, who's the Buddha who lived, the person who lived about 2,500 years ago in what's now northeastern India, said, "In this treasure stupa there is the whole body of a Tathagata. Once in the past, innumerable tens of millions of billions of countless worlds to the east." That way. And in a land named Treasure Purity, there was a Buddha named Abundant Treasures. When that Buddha was originally practicing the Bodhisattva way, he made a great vow saying, "After I become a Buddha and then extinct, if there is a place in any land in the universe where the Dharma Flower Sutra is taught, in order that I may listen to it, my stupa will appear there, bearing testimony to the sutra and praising it, saying, 'Well done.'" So this is really strange. First I want to mention this. In this treasure stupa, there is the whole body of a Tathagata. Tathagata is another name for Buddha. It means one who comes and goes in thusness or suchness. So there's the whole body of a Tathagata. And part of why I like this sutra is it's important in our sotos and tradition. The Japanese 13th century monk Dogen, who founded this branch of Zen, Soto Zen, that we practice here, loved the Lotus Sutra and talked about it a lot. But he had a whole essay in his one of his masterworks, Shobo Genzo, that where he talked about this whole body of the Tathagata. And Dogen talks about this in an interesting way. He says that this sutra is the whole body of the Tathagata. The mark of reality of all things in the present time is this sutra. So that's not how we usually think of Zen maybe in America, but this is what Dogen said. And then Dogen relates the sutra and the whole of reality itself to this, to the long-lived Shakyamuni Buddha, which we'll get to, we've mentioned, but that's in chapter 16, who has this very long lifespan. But the point is that, and he talks about that how that resulted from the merits of the original Bodhisattva practices, but he goes on about this whole body of the Tathagata as the sutra itself and what we are doing by our practice, how we are keeping that alive. So, again, there's a side of Zen that's just kind of very down to earth and plain and simple, and but in the background is this wondrous, strange stuff. So, so now going back to the part I just read, this Buddha, Abundant Treasures, says that the Buddha says about him that when he was practicing, he made this vow that said, after I become a Buddha and then extinct, and now he's extinct, he's in the stupa. If there's any place in any land in the whole universe where the Dharma Flower Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, is being taught, my stupa appears there, bearing testimony to the sutra and praising it, saying, well done. So it says this right inside the Lotus Sutra, the text called the Lotus Sutra. So there's lots of really strange things about the Lotus Sutra, and this is one of the more interesting, that right in the middle of the Lotus Sutra, they talk about the Lotus Sutra a lot. So this happens in some of the other sutra means scripture in Buddhism. So this happens in some of the other Buddhist sutras too. But in the Lotus Sutra, it's just kind of way over the top. And here's this ancient Buddha who appears whenever the Lotus Sutra is taught, and he's been doing this for a long time. And he's in this mummy in this stupa. And then the Buddha said, Shakyamuni is telling the story. He says, when that Buddha had finished the Buddha way and his extinction approaching, he said to his whole assembly of many beings, after my extinction, if anyone wants to make offerings to my whole body, again, the whole body of the Buddha, they should put up a great stupa. Thus, throughout all the whole worlds of the universe, in any place at all where someone teaches the Dharma Flower Sutra by his divine powers and the power of his vow, that Buddha has his treasure stupa containing his whole body. And so one of the bodhisattvas said to Shakyamuni Buddha, hey, world honored one, we want to see this Buddha's body. So at that point, the stupa, this reliquary, is floating in midair with all these jewels around it, and it's closed. And then Shakyamuni said, this Buddha, Abundant Treasures, has taken a vow that whenever his stupa appears in the presence of a Buddha speaking the Dharma Flower or Lotus Sutra, if someone wants me to show my body, let the Buddhas who are embodiments of that Buddha and are preaching the Dharma in the worlds of the ten directions return together and assemble in one place, and my body will appear. So this keeps getting stranger. So here he's saying that Shakyamuni Buddha, who we know lived around 2,500 years ago in what's now northeastern India, has embodiments of Shakyamuni in many lands and many worlds, and they all need to come and appear in order for the Buddha Abundant Treasures to show himself. So so this bodhisattva says to the Buddha, please, we'd like to see the Buddhas who embody you in worship and make offerings to them and pay our respects. So then the Buddha emitted a beam of light from his tuft of white hair. That's what they call the third eye. And in the very beginning of the whole Dharma Flower Sutra, this happened. And one of the great bodhisattvas said, oh, I know what that is. I've seen that before. He's going to teach the Lotus Sutra now. So this is kind of like a Mobius strip or something. There's all kinds of weird things going on. Anyway, again, the Buddha emits this light from this tuft of white hair. And immediately he makes visible all the Buddhas in 5 million billion myriads of lands to the east. Again, that way. And all those lands had crystal for their ground and so forth. Anyway, each of these Buddhas in all those lands spoke to their multitudes of bodhisattvas, saying, let's go to Shakyamuni Buddha's world and make offerings to the treasure stupa of the Buddha Abundant Treasures. So that happens. So again, this is, sometimes people want to hear, like, practical, down-to-earth instructions about how to practice. And we do that too. But this is something else. This is, again, these are inspirations for how to bring forth this sense of wonder in our practice. And, you know, for the people who are doing the practice period, there are four chapters, four stories we're talking about, and I've asked them all to, to pick one to focus on. So you don't have to focus on this if this is too wild for you, but I just wanted to let you know about it. So all of these other Shakyamuni Buddhas appear below this treasure stupa. And they assemble together, and they're each seated on a lion seat, and they all want the treasure stupa to open so they can see this ancient Buddha, abundant treasures. So Shakyamuni Buddha gets up from his seat and goes up into the air. And they all are watching, and it says, Shakyamuni Buddha opened the door of the stupa of the seven precious materials with the fingers of his right hand. So I guess he like that or something. And then there came a great sound like the withdrawing of the bar when the gate to a great city is opened. And suddenly the whole congregation saw this ancient Buddha, abundant treasures, on a lion seat in the treasure stupa, this mummified body, but all in one piece, sitting as though he were in meditation, it says. And they heard him saying, well done, Shakyamuni Buddha. You have preached the Dharma Flower Sutra gladly, which is what I have come to this place to hear. So, then what happens in this story is that, so this abundant treasures Buddha, this ancient Buddha from, I don't know, some previous Big Bang or something, you know, it's from a really long time ago. He says to Shakyamuni, half his seat to him, and he says, Shakyamuni Buddha, take the seat. So Shakyamuni Buddha enters the stupa, and he takes half the seat, and they sit together with folded legs, cross-legged. So sometimes you'll see Buddhist images or two Buddhas sitting next to each other. That's always a reference to this story and what goes on for a long time after, because this is the beginning in the sutra, of what's called the ceremony in midair, and it goes through chapter 22. So a large part of the sutra happens in midair. So what happens next is that Shakyamuni Buddha uses his divine powers to bring all of the great assembly, humans and heavenly beings and all kinds of beings who've been listening to him tell the Lotus Sutra. He brings them up into the air too, and in a loud voice he addresses them all, saying, "Who is able to teach the wonderful Dharma Flower Sutra everywhere throughout this world? Now indeed is the time. Before long, the Tathagata, the Buddha, meaning himself, will enter Nirvana. So that it will last forever, the Buddha wants to entrust this wondrous Dharma Flower Sutra to someone." Okay, so that's the basic story in this chapter. That they're all up in midair. And Buddha and Shakyamuni Buddha, our Buddha, and Abundant Treasures Buddha are sitting next to each other. And in a way, that's a model for what happens during practice period. In practice period, Douglas, our head student, isn't here today. He'll be back tomorrow evening. But in practice period, we have the teacher and the head student, or Shuso, sitting next to each other. It's a little bit like this scene from the Lotus Sutra, and we have a couple former Shusos here with us. This is the story, and it's really strange. And there are many, many different aspects to talk about this. First of all, just the idea that there have been Buddhas before. So we know that Shakyamuni Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, was a human guy who, the story that we have, and there are various stories, we don't know exactly really what he said, but he lived in northeastern India. He was the son of some kind of king, and was had this very sheltered life. And then he realized that people suffer out there outside his palace, and he left the palace and wandered around, and eventually, you know, he wanted to help relieve suffering. And that's the point of all of this. And we talked about a previous chapter in the sutra, in chapter 2, chapter on skillful means, which talks about the single great cause for Buddha's appearing in the world, which is simply to help beings into the path of awakening, to help relieve suffering. That's the point of all this. How do we enter into the path to... Buddha just means the awakened one. How do we see our own awakening? How do we see this possibility of being present and awake? And I know some of you, when you're sitting zazen, you know, might be sleepy at times, and your mind might be, your thoughts might be rattling around. But still, to just sit and be present and upright and pay attention, whatever's going on. Lots of thinking or sleepiness or some ache in your knee or your back or whatever, just to be present and upright. And settle into that. So we each have our own way to be Buddha. We each have our own way to be awake. I can't tell you how to be Buddha, but this is available. And there have been Buddhas, you know, going way back. And this is one of them. This is this ancient Buddha who always appears whenever the Lotus Sutra is taught. So he's somewhere here. So part of what's really strange about this sutra, again, is this self-referential aspect that is referring to itself all the time. Right in the Lotus Sutra, it talks about this Buddha who comes to listen to the Lotus Sutra whenever it is preached. And it's been preached long in the past, and it's been preached in the it will be preached in the future. And Buddha is asking, who will come back? You know, he asks, who will come back in the future evil age and preach the Lotus Sutra? So we'll be talking more about that and our responsibility for keeping alive the practice and the teaching. So there's this, again, this quality of the sutra talking about itself, and especially to the many references to the Lotus Sutra as something expounded many ages ago, or as about to be expounded, or even as hopefully to be expounded in the distant future. So the Lotus Sutra functions within itself, both as a sacred text or scripture, and as a kind of commentary or guidebook to its own use, beyond the literal confines of the written words. How do we appreciate the Lotus Sutra? And in some traditions, it becomes a devotional object. But in our tradition, for Dogen, the self-proclamation of the Dharma, of the teaching in the Lotus Sutra, is an aspect of a kind of rhetorical style or style of teaching, rather than some external object. There are many examples of that. One of Dogen's teachings, so he was in the 13th century in Japan, one of his teachings in his extensive record, Eihikoroku, which is very short talks, he said, this is the whole talk, he said, "This mountain monk has not lectured for the sake of the assembly for a long time. Why is this? On my behalf, the Buddha hall, the monk's hall, the valley streams, the pine and bamboo, every moment endlessly speaks fully for the sake of all people. Have you heard it or not? If you say you heard it, what did you hear? If you say you have not heard it, you do not keep need to keep the you are not keeping the precepts." So something about this way of talking about something that is present in ways we don't usually think of. Something about this is referred to in this, is brought up in this sense of this self-referential aspect of the sutra. And we could say that it demonstrates the non-separation of the goals of liberation from the skillful modes of the Buddha. there's this non-duality of purpose and context of the Lotus Sutra as a text that itself represents and enacts veneration of the potential of the world for liberation. So, the Lotus Sutra, talking about itself, is in many ways like our Zazen practice. In our tradition, from the San Francisco Zen Center and Suzuki Roshi lineage, we talk about non-gaining mind a lot. It doesn't mean that there are not benefits to the practice, but it means that, one way to say it is that the benefits of the practice are not some goals that we have in mind, not what we think they are. This is not merely another self-help technique. That when we practice, something is happening much deeper. And when people first encounter the Lotus Sutra or other texts like it, it's kind of bizarre, and some of you have had negative reactions to it, and that's understandable. But we're still, talking about it. But in some ways, the Lotus Sutra talking about itself is like Zazen. We don't sit Zazen for the sake of something else. We don't do this meditation practice in order to get something somewhere else. We actually are present and feel what it feels like to be here, this body-mind, this morning. So we sit, and whatever's happening, if we have lots of thoughts, if we're troubled by some problem in our life this week, if we have some ache and pain, if we are sleepy or whatever, just to pay attention to what is actually going on here in each breath, beyond our ideas of who we are, beyond our stories about ourselves and the world and so forth, just to be present. So in some ways, this is like this Lotus Sutra talking about itself. We don't sit Zazen for the sake of something else. We sit Zazen because of this meditation. So there's much more to say about this. But part of this is to actually appreciate this world. Even though there's all this highfalutin stuff about these ancient Buddhas and all these colorful jewels and so forth, it's about seeing this concrete stuff in our world as itself the expression of awakening. So I'm just going to read a little bit I've read before from a wonderful book by a scholar named William LaFleur called The Karma of Words. He says, "The narratives of the Lotus Sutra are not a means to an end beyond themselves. Their concrete modes of expression is not chaff to be dispensed with in order to attain a more abstract, rational, or spiritual truth." The Lotus is unequivocal on this point. It says, "One may seek in every one of the 10 directions, but will find no skillful modes other than the Buddha's." So part of the Lotus Sutra is this very inclusiveness, this very inclusive sense of everything's included, everyone's included. We sit facing the wall not as a way of hiding from the world or keeping the world out. In this practice, we don't build walls to keep people out who we don't like, foreigners or whomever. We face the wall because it shows us ourselves. It's a window to how we are connected with everyone. So LaFleur says, "This accounts for what may seem to be an inordinate amount of praise directed by the sutra toward itself," which is a strange thing, this book talking about itself and how wonderful it is. "It also implies that within the sutra there's an unmistakable philosophical move opposite to that in Plato's Republic and Western philosophy, a move to affirm the complete reality of the world of concrete phenomena, in spite of the fact that they are impermanent." So this tradition, and going back to India, but even more as it came to Japan, appreciates impermanence, appreciates the beauty of things as they're fading. So I can say more about all of this. And again, the point of the Bodhisattva activity that the Lotus Sutra is encouraging is exactly the relief of suffering, but I wanted to shift, and today's one of those days I'm going to talk about too much, and sometimes I try and get too much into one talk, and I'm going to do that today, because it's May Day, so I want to mention May Day in the context of bodhisattva activity. May 1st is known as May Day around the world. We don't know it so much in this country, so I want to talk about that. And this is from an interview by an historian named Peter Linebaugh, who wrote a book called The Incomplete, True, Authentic, and Wonderful History of May Day. And I'll try and bring this back to bodhisattva activity. But May Day was created as a workers' holiday. And there's actually two different aspects of May Day. Do they have May Day in Sweden? Oh, good. Yeah, well, we don't really celebrate it here so much, but I'm going to talk about that. One aspect of, this author, Peter Linbaugh, is bringing this up, and he says there's two different stories about May Day, and it's important on this May Day in particular, he says, because on this May Day, people all over the United States are thinking about what is a political revolution. And they're thinking about what is socialism, because one of the presidential candidates has talked about that and talked about the ways in which our ordinary world is not serving people so well. And again, the idea of the bodhisattva is to be helpful and to relieve suffering for all beings, not just some particular kinds of beings or people from some particular country. So he talks about the first meaning of May Day, which goes back, he says, to agriculture. And this is, May Day goes back to the sun and springtime. So in many cultures, and traditionally in Europe, maybe more in pre-Christian Europe, but throughout Europe also, it's remained that this is, because of springtime, this is the beginning. The earth has turned in its relationship to solar energy. Great, thank you. So this is a story of fertility. Winter's over. It was still a little chilly, you know, this morning and yesterday, and you know, but the leaves, even in Chicago, the leaves are out in the trees and flowers are out. Winter's over. Summer's upon us. It's the time of fruition and dancing and happiness. So traditionally on May Day, in the earlier form of May Day, there were maypoles. And in America, in 1627, there was one in the Boston Bay, in the colony there. And people danced around the maypole. And the Puritans got very upset and kind of shut it down. But there's this traditional, I want to say pagan, but that has such negative connotations. There's this context of the earth is alive, and we're going to see that in the bodhisattva springing from the earth in that story. So that's one aspect of May Day. The second aspect of May Day has a lot to do with Chicago. So May Day was also a workers' holiday. And after the American Civil War, workers, women, disabled people felt empowered and thrilled at the victory. So there was this huge freedom struggle in the Civil War. And then that connected with the ancient May Day story. And people started to agitate for income equality, well, not quite income equality, but for rights for workers. And this began the 8-hour workday movement. And this all centered around Chicago. There were things happening in California, and there were things happening in my hometown in Pittsburgh. And, you know, the labor movement happened in a lot of places, but Chicago is really a big center of it. So there was an agitation for 8-hour workday and they said that there should be 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours of play. That was the slogan in every day. This started in Chicago because the McCormick Reaper was created in Chicago and by iron molders. And so May Day became the celebration of workers' rights. And in 1886, on the 1st of May, there was a large demonstration at the McCormick factory. And the police, who seem to always represent the 1% or whatever, shot 4 workers dead. In response to this police violence, just as we now have the Black Lives Matter movement responding to police violence, there was a meeting in Haymarket Square in Chicago a few days later on the 4th of May. It was a large demonstration. And sometime later, after most of it had broken up, there was a stick of dynamite thrown. And there was one policeman killed and 7 casualties among the workers. And we don't know, historians don't know who threw the dynamite to this day. The police said it was the demonstrators. The demonstrators said it was police provocateur. There's a really wonderful book about this that Nyozan lent me after I'd escaped California and moved to Chicago 9 years ago. It's a book by a man named James Green who called Death in the Haymarket, and I highly recommend it, and talks all about this. And I'm just mentioning a little bit of this now. But again, this trade union movement was very active in the early 1880s. It developed in the late 1870s in Chicago. And this book, you know, has maps of different parts of Chicago and where all of these things happen. It's a wonderful book. But as a result of this dynamite at this rally, protesting the police violence, they rounded up not people who were even there, but 8 people who were leaders of the labor movement, and they were charged with murder and found guilty, and 4 of them were hanged in November 11, 1887. And not to go into too much detail, but I felt like I should say something on May Day. How many of you know who Albert Parsons was? Laurel, is that? Anyway, Albert. So I wanted to say something about Albert Parsons because I think he was a great bodhisattva, and he lived in Chicago, and he was one of the 4 that was hanged. And he was a very eloquent. Very eloquent guy. He actually was from Texas, and he had fought in the Confederacy. But after the Civil War, he worked in Texas against the Ku Klux Klan and during Reconstruction, on behalf of newly freed African Americans. And he got into a lot of trouble, and they forced him to leave, and he came to Chicago. And if you look at that book, or if you look him up in Google, it's a very eloquent guy talking about how he didn't belong to one country, that his country was the whole world, that he spoke on behalf of working people. He was arrested, but then escaped and was in hiding successfully in Wisconsin, but he decided to just return for the trial. So he walked into the trial the first day and anyway ended up being hanged. And his speeches are really eloquent. Some of the speakers at the trial said the day will come. When our silence will be more powerful than the voices you throttle. And throughout the world, especially in Mexico, but in England and Ireland and France and Italy, that event of these guys being killed became part of May Day and the 8-hour workday movement and the 40-hour week and the weekend we owe to these guys. I wanted to mention him because I think he was a great guy. And what happened later is that May Day, Peter Linbaugh says the rulers of the United States, the 1%, the slavocrats, the Gilded Age capitalists back then, the billionaires and police forces behind them, at the end of the 19th century got together and separated May Day from that workers' struggle. So President Grover Cleveland in 1894 was forced by labor unions to have some kind of Labor Day, so they moved it to September 1st, which is Labor Day, and we have that in America now. And then May 1st, President Eisenhower decided May 1st he would call Law Day. So anyway, a little bit of history, a little bit of Chicago history. The point of bringing this up, though, also in terms of the Lotus Sutra and these bodhisattva activities is that, you know, we have bodhisattva precepts or ethics that have to do with benefiting all beings. And the Lotus Sutra is very much about that, including all beings. Not just the very wealthy, not just Americans, not just people with certain skin color, not just people of certain ethnicity, that we're about benefiting all beings. And to see this sense of the possibility and the reality of awakening happening in many, many different times, in many different places, even in, you know, I don't know if it's accurate technically to call it previous Big Bangs, but that's how I think of it. It's, you know, previous cycles of world history. Before Shakyamuni Buddha, there were Buddhas, and here's one of them who appears in the Lotus Sutra and appears whenever these stories about bodhisattvas are spoken. It says right inside the Lotus Sutra. So this is the background of this practice of just being present and sitting and enjoying our breath, our inhale and exhale, and being upright and seeing what it is like to be the person on your cushion or chair here this morning. And we do this together with everyone. So each of you, each of us is a product of many, many, many beings. Many beings we don't even know. Of course, we can remember parents and siblings and teachers and friends, but you know, there are many beings we don't even know who contributed. So if you have an 8-hour work day, you can thank Albert Parsons and those other guys, you know. That was too much to fit into one talk, but oh well. We have time for one or two comments or questions, if anyone has one. Yes, Bo.
I just wanted to mention Albert Parsons' wife.
Good.
Yeah, Lucy Parsons survived him. I think she was African American too. I think she lived for many years in Chicago, then continuing like the labor activism, social activism. So she was like a big part of his life, and then I think maybe into her 70s or 80s. So
thank you for mentioning. I meant to mention Lucy Parsons. She was also a great bodhisattva, and for decades after he was executed. And she, I think she was part African American, part Native American. And they got married in Texas, but she came with him to Chicago. Thank you. Other comments or responses or questions about anything? Hey, Alex.
but having got past that, part of my motivation for reading was actually I liked the idea that this challenged my notion of Buddhism and kind of what
good.
I want from it. I guess initially I want a quick, easy explanation of within what I'm reading about what the lesson is I'm supposed to take from it.
Good. Yes. Yeah, I've been waiting for George Lucas or Spielberg or somebody to do a movie of the Lotus Sutra, but I think it's too far out. The special effects haven't caught up yet. So thank you. Yeah. Yes. Aisha? Or. Oh, yes, good. Your name is Ashley?
Ashley.
Hi, I'm Tyken.
I'm new to the Buddhist practice, from what I guess I'm understanding from what you're saying. Is this easily reconciled with the universe theory? I mean, we're talking about all of these infinite Buddhas and the future and the past and these kind of infinite creatures. I'm talking about, I guess,
Bring it on. Yeah, I. We have a physicist here, and I'm interested in modern physics, but I don't really understand it. But I think all of modern science is catching up in some ways with Mahayana Buddhism, and this sense of parallel universes and different contexts and different dimensions, and who knows where these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come from. It's maybe not just a distant solar system or galaxy, but maybe so part of what these texts do is to, as Alice was saying, get us out of our usual sense of Buddhism or anything else as just something that we do to get something else. If you come, you know, it's true that if you do this practice, you know, that it develops some sense of calm and some sense of settledness and openness and you know, this kind of text also appeals to the imagination, the sense of spaciousness. And it's not that we should get rid of our rational, discriminating scientific mind. That can be very useful and helpful for all kinds of good purposes. But this is about a deeper reality that goes beyond what we think we know. So yes, whatever you bring in from, you know, anywhere. Yeah, thank you, good. Yeah, you're in the right place. Yes, last one, Howard. Sure.
Whenever he hears it, beyond space and time, to come and listen to this, to show up, sit down. He's already sitting, always sitting for all this time. It doesn't matter, time doesn't matter. To come and listen to the Lotus Sutra. And to me, that's an amazing, inspirational image to use for my own practice.
Good. That's the point of this is, you know, these weird stories, the only reason to look at them is in as much as they help us support our own practice. So, yeah, and in some ways just, so the Lotus Sutra talks about the value of just reading or reciting a line of the Lotus Sutra, and our sitting is the same way. And Dogen talks about it that way, just to sit and be present and not try and get something else from it, but to actually enjoy the next breath. Is like the Lotus Sutra, and we'll talk more about that as we proceed in the practice period. For those who are in it formally or not, just you're welcome to come and listen.